Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Things bring a smile to my face more than memories of Montreal. My maternal family hails from that city, and I spent many happy times there, including 5 summers working at Camp Merrimack in the Laurentian Mountains. So it was only natural I would become a fan of the Montreal Expos and disappointed when they moved to Washington, D.C. I still have some souvenirs from the years at Gerry Park, as well as Olympic Stadium. I spent a week in the press box there during the final homestand of 2003, doing research for a book on the demise of the team, because it looked like that would be their final season in Montreal. But it wasn't, and that project went by the wayside. While there have been a few books about the Expos here and there, it wasn't until Jonah Carey published Up, Up, and Away earlier this year that we finally have a definitive history of the franchise. To mix sports metaphors, it was a slam dunk that I would speak with Carey, who grew up in Montreal, at some point. Here's the result.
Jonah Carey, bienvenue à l'atelier à livre du baseball.
Thanks for having me.
So, I Googled it, as you said in your book, and I still don't understand how that was ruled an inside the park home run for Marquis Grissom.
I think it should have been. It was a tough play to make on that play. You know,
yeah,
you're going back, whatever.
But the outfielder also bobbled the ball and picking it up.
Sure, that's fine. That was an interesting way to jump into the conversation, but sure, yes. One argued that it's a triple, that's fine. I got no problem.
So does a true Expos fan follow the Nationals, or is that no longer germane?
Let me ask you this. Who would you root for? Who do you root for?
I root for the Expos. But
okay.
I root for the Mets, and if I'm not rooting for the Mets, I'm rooting for the Nationals.
Okay, that's interesting. But you're not born and raised in Montreal like I am.
No, I have a large family there from my mother's side, and that was a place of great sentiment and nostalgia for me, and that's how I got involved with the Expos in the first place back in 1969, but no, I'm not of Montreal.
Right, so I think that if you're from a place and that is the major reason that you root for them, you don't have much incentive to root for the next iteration of that team because your attachment is geographical and your attachment is based on your family and friends and the experiences that you had when you were growing up with the team. So I actually moved to Washington, D.C. after graduation. The Expos followed my lead, moving from Montreal to Washington, in fact. But that aside, there was no real reason for me to latch on to Washington, nor should there be a reason for anybody else. I mean, it's a totally different franchise. Not that it makes a huge difference, but the Nationals don't honor the Expos in any way. There's no numbers. There's no history. It's kind of like the Browns moving to Baltimore. I mean, there were no Browns fans that said, oh, I'm a Ravens fan now. That didn't happen. I don't think Sonic fans root for the Thunder either. If anything, I think there's animus in some cases because the feeling is, hey, that was our team, and you took it away. I don't have any animus, but I also don't follow the Nationals whatsoever. I'm completely neutral on the Nationals.
But it's not quite the same as, let's say, the Brooklyn Dodgers moving to Los Angeles, where it's a question of that owner deciding to go where they follow the money and move across the country. You know, the Expos didn't have that kind of situation.
Right. Yeah, they didn't have that kind of situation. And you know what? Can you repeat that one more time? I want to process that question again.
Okay. The Brooklyn Dodgers owner picked up the team and moved when
right.
He couldn't get the stadium he wanted in Brooklyn, but it was still the O'Malley's team at that point. The Expos didn't really have ownership at that point. They were owned by Major League Baseball. So it wasn't a question of, well, I'm totally against the owners now, so I'm not going to follow the team.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. There really were no connections, no ownership, no anything, really. It wasn't one of those things that was continuous. And by the way, I'll point out that many Dodgers fans gave up on the Dodgers at
right.
that point. That was very much a neighborhood team. So, you know, you had a situation where people felt jilted and, you know, West Coast was 3,000 miles away and less accessible now than it is today where cross-country flights are sort of a given. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people gave up on it.
Now, when the Expos played at Gerry Park, would you consider that a neighborhood team?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so to a certain extent. Although Montreal, Brooklyn, you know, it was just an enclave. I mean, obviously a lot of people lived in Brooklyn, but it wasn't quite the same. Montreal's a huge city. There's 3 million people now, and there were plenty then, too. So it had a neighborhood feel in the sense of where they played. It was a very small, kind of homey stadium, but it still represented an entire city and really an entire country. That was the only team in all of Canada until 1976. So I think it kind of had that effect.
But when they moved to Jerry Park, did it have that kind of neighborhood feel anymore? I mean to Olympic Stadium.
I guess not. I mean, you know, it was different. My Olympic Stadium was huge and was built for the Olympics, and it was just a different kind of feel. So I suppose not. Like I said, Jerry Park gave it something of a neighborhood feel, but the city was large. I think that Olympic Stadium kind of wiped out the rest of it. Yeah, that's a fair point. I would say that.
Now, you're obviously a huge fan of the Expos. Did that present any special problem when writing the book?
No. If anything, I think it enhanced the book. And I did discuss this with my editor, who's also an Expos fan, by the way, an American with Canadian parents who grew up in the States and went to McGill. And he and I talked about this, and we were, you know, among the many things, at first I didn't even want to do the book because, not because I didn't think it'd be fun, but because I thought, who's going to read this book? This team is irrelevant, and they haven't existed for 7 years or whatever. And it's only really in the last 3 years, i.e. concurrent with me writing the book, that all this interest has come along in the team again, which we can get to later, I'm sure. But, to answer your question, the fandom, I think, helped. This is something I talked about with my editor, Paul, and we said, how do we want to do this? He said, you should make it, in small part, a memoir, that if you do that, it will enhance certain portions of the book and make it more personal. So I did that, but without compromising on my reporting. I went out and I talked to everybody that I possibly could in the universe, and I just went by the facts. So I'll give you, for instance, it's super easy to bag on Jeffrey Loria. Super, super, super easy. I kind of didn't do that, really. I mean, I talked about some of the misdeeds as they occurred, but I think I presented a pretty maybe the most balanced view that a real Expos fan could possibly present of the guy, namely that the team was hosed as soon as Charles Bronson sold the team in 1991, way before Loria came onto the team. And I don't think that Loria had an intention, quite frankly, to execute the team, as some people believe, and as a lawsuit was brought. I think it was one of those deals where he wanted to give it a go. I called out the local business community for completely not wanting to play ball with the guy, and then wrote that ultimately Loria just said, listen, this is untenable. I got to do what I got to do. And, you know, him cash calling out the other partners, you would do that even if you wanted to support the team ad infinitum in Montreal. You'd say, listen, this cannot be a viable product if you guys are going to be deadbeat, so I'm going to buy you out, essentially. If that's the case, or if you're a carpetbagger, those are the same machinations you would go through. So, yeah, I presented it in that way, and I think that some people, quite frankly, were a little surprised by that, and a couple of people were even flummoxed by it. They didn't like it at all. They said, why did you go after Loria? You let him off easy. And I said, no, man, I'm a journalist first and foremost. I might be talking about how much I love Tim Raines in the book, but that doesn't mean I'm going to distort the facts of what happened. And I think that a reader who pays attention, who goes through the, 400 pages, and really looks at it honestly would say, you know what, this guy loves the Expos, but this is a piece of journalism, and he tried hard to chronicle the story of this franchise as it really happened.
Now, that's one of the things I noticed, is that you don't seem to come down hard on Loria or Claude Brochu. And I found that, you know, from all the things I have read beforehand and all the things I still read about Loria and his relationship with the Marlins, where it seems that he's done the same thing, is that he had a high-quality team, and then once they succeeded, he starts, you know, trying to profit as much as he can from it. Obviously, it's a different situation because the Expos did not have that civic backing that other teams seem to have. So who is the villain in all this for the loss of the Expos to Montreal?
It was the owner, the consortium of local owners. And when I say local owners, I'm not talking about Bob Boone and the Bodega. I'm talking about Bell and Canadian Pacific and these multi-billion-dollar companies. They did not have the foresight or the desire or anything to invest in the team. Basically, what happened, it's chronicled in the book, is Brochu, who was leading the search committee, basically went around to all these different companies and said, okay, you want in, you could be a partner. And there's a famous story in the book of this gentleman, Emil Cio, who was a big shot at Bell. Bell's like AT&T, basically. And Emil Cio is sitting there wearing a suit and he's smoking a cigar, a typical fat cat kind of thing. And this scene is recounted to me, you know, stone by stone. And Cio basically says, all right, here's $5 million. And he looks him in the eye and he says, never ask me for money again. Never bother me again. And it's just like you have this image of this guy, this just unlikable person who's just doing this, and this is really what it became to be. So, okay, maybe you're all putting $5 million in 1991, but guess what? There's salary inflation. You know, the game grows, and you have to grow with it, and that, those guys, those owners, those companies were not willing to grow along with it. Now, Brochu and the search committee struggled mightily just to find those partners, so it's possible that it was just a lack, you know, the business community in general failed. I mean, I put a lot of the blame on them. Nobody had the guts to do it. But even then, I leaven the blame at least a little bit because I look at the Montreal Canadiens during that time. The Montreal Canadiens are the crown jewel of hockey. They're the Yankees. They've won as many, almost as many Stanley Cups as the Yankees have won World Series. Granted, none in 21 years, but they have been, you know, this great historic franchise. And nobody, and this is, by the way, the 90s, right after they'd won in 93, nobody would invest in the Canadiens. They'd go up for sale, and nobody local would step up, spend money to buy the team and build a new arena. It finally took an American named George Gillette to do it. And what happened was, at first, there was distrust of this guy because it's a very provincial place. I mean, name your most provincial part of the U.S., which, you know, I lived in New England. I think you can make a case for Boston or New England. But whatever, Texas, you pick it. Quebec could be worse. I mean, Quebec is one of those things where it's not just provincial in the sense of are you from here or not, it's do you speak the language. Right. You know, it's very, very cultural and very, very divisive. And so Gillette comes along and buys the team and says he's going to build an arena. Nobody trusts the guy. And in the end, he does it. Everybody trusts him. Everybody loves him. And then he sells the team a few years later and makes a killing. Why? Because in business, you have to spend money to make money. And nobody else was willing to do that in Montreal. Not for the Canadiens, and certainly not for the Expos, who did not have the profile that the famous Habitant did.
And what about at the very end? What about the role Major League Baseball itself had in the demise of the team?
I mean, I have no love for Bud Selig, but that's because of 1994. That's not because of what happened at the end. I don't believe, you know, there was, as I mentioned before, there was a lawsuit brought by the partners who were left behind, arguing that Jeffrey Loria and Bud Selig had colluded to basically execute the team. No, that's not what happened. What happened is everybody tried to give it a go. It didn't work, and so they went about the process of moving the team to another city, which was their right when you have an unviable product. I love Montreal. It's a fantastic city. But the bottom line is, fans, rightly, by the way, if you're in an abusive relationship, you should try to get out. This was an abusive relationship. No, I mean, I'm not trying to make light of any of that, but you know, this really was what it was. And so they felt that they were jilted, but the bottom line is that nobody stepped up. So, of course, Major League Baseball has to look for other avenues, and Jeffrey Loria, who owns the team at this point, is perfectly within his right to sell the team at that point. So, you know, Selig choosing Washington or MLB owning the team or whatever, I'm pretty fine with all that. The two things that I object to were how 94 was handled. I believe that there didn't need to be a work stoppage, and Selig was a major conspirator in making that happen, which had a major deleterious impact on the Expos. And the other thing, which is kind of a minor thing but kind of not, is at the end of the 2003 season, the Expos were in the race. They were tied for the wild card lead on August 28, 2003, right before Labor Day, right before the rosters were in the stand. They lost a couple of games. They fell a couple of games back. That's fine. But you go to September 1st, and every team in the majors can call up a few guys. Not superstars, but, you know, a reliever here, a third catcher there, whatever. The Expos were forbidden from doing that. It would have cost a couple $100,000, maybe even for like 5-6 guys, because we're talking about, you know, league minimum salary prorated for 1 month, and they were not allowed to do that. And that was clear conflict of interest. That was Major League Baseball owned by, or rather the Expos owned by the other teams, owned by the other 29 teams, basically. And the mandate came down that said the Expos are not allowed to call up players. That is a violation of fair play. That is other teams saying, hey, we don't want the Expos to make the playoffs. Let's do something to undercut them. That I really, really objected to. I don't think they would have made the playoffs anyway, because I don't think Tremel Sledge was going to be the difference between them getting there or not, quite frankly. But it was absolutely, completely unethical and chafes me. And I absolutely reported in the book as such. I did not pull punches when I came to that.
It almost seems that had the Expos succeeded at that point, Major League Baseball would have been embarrassed, because it seems no matter what they tried to do, the Expos were punching away.
Well, you're sure. And, you know, we saw it in 2002, Omar Minaya, and there's a whole other book to be written about Omar Minaya, who's an interesting cat, but he trades Grady Sizemore, Cliff Lee, and Brandon Phillips for Bartolo Colon. I mean, they went for it in 2002. They traded for Cliff Floyd years after he came in as a fresh-faced rookie. At this point, he's a veteran and an established, really good player. They traded a bunch of prospects for him, too. They were trying. And then in 2003, they were really good. You know, that was Vladdy in his peak. Javier Vasquez was terrific. Great double play combination with Jose Vitra and Orlando Cabrera. They had real good players, stars on that team that had developed before, you know, years earlier. They'd come through the Expo system in maybe the mid-90s or so. So this was kind of the last fruit of a very productive farm system. And you can try to sabotage all you want, but, you know, Vladdy in his prime is going to play. I don't care if you put him on the move. That's it. He's going to be a great player. That's how it goes. And so, yeah, they really did have a chance at it. And I think MLB would have been embarrassed. And more to the point, you know, just to reemphasize this point, when I say MLB, when we say MLB, we mean the Florida Marlins, who were competing directly with the Expos. We mean whatever, the Cubs and the Yankees and the Astros and everybody else. The other teams specifically had no interest in the Expos winning that year.
In general, looking back over the franchise from its beginning, did players enjoy coming to Montreal to play?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Now, are you talking about visiting players, or are you talking about players who actually played?
I'm talking about members of the Expos.
So here's what I would say. The answer is absolutely yes, but I think it was more enthusiastic at the beginning than it was at the end, because at the end it was obviously depressing and they had to travel to Puerto Rico or whatever. So it's something that we don't talk about the last 3 years, which were an abomination and kind of not the Expos. The answer is yes, absolutely. And it was for very, very different reasons. If you talk about the beginnings of the franchise, this was a time when players were not making $1 million. And so they would live in, you know, homes in the suburbs. It could be next to where you or I live, nice kind of middle-class neighborhood, whatever. And they would do their thing, and that would be great. And they really liked it. And they stayed in the off-season, and they would play rec hockey or things like that. And they were absolutely part of the community. Rusty Staub lived there all year long. And so did Steve Rogers and Jorgensen and Bateman and Stoneman, all of them, you name it. They were all lived there. And Singleton did. And so they really enjoyed being part of the community. You get to later on, and they start to institute the new rules with service time and so forth, and the Expos start thinking about trading guys before they're going to hit free agency. The rosters start to skew really young. So the rosters start to look like a bunch of 22- and 23-year-old single guys, often Latin, because the Expos were really good at that, who just lived by themselves. So at that point, then you come to realize, wait a minute, Montreal is also maybe the best party city in North America. It's an insanely great place to be. You know, everything is happening. It's late hours. Women are incredible. Food is incredible. Bars are incredible. Everything is incredible there. If you're a 22-year-old, good-looking, you know, well-to-do athlete living downtown in Montreal in those days, my God, I mean, it's an amusement park. It's an amazing thing. So all those guys, I mean, and there's no point in understating that either. So all those guys, including guys like Vladimir Guerrero, really loved it. And moreover, because they had that big Latin presence, you know, sometimes you go to Cleveland or Milwaukee or whatever, not to take anything away from the city, but it can feel a little uncomfortable. You can feel like you're very much in the minority and you don't fit in or whatever. Montreal's already a multicultural city. Granted, it's French and English as the two main cultures, but it's absolutely a melting pot in general. So if you go there, you speak a different language or you are different in some way, that's no problem. Everybody's different. You know, I was trilingual growing up. That was normal to do that kind of thing. And so for a guy like Vlad or whoever, Vidro, Cabrera, Vasquez, Pedro Martinez, Danis Martinez, any of those guys, it was great. They all loved it. They all had a great time. And I think they thrived in Montreal.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the process of creating the book. How hard is it to market a baseball book in Canada?
Well, if it's about the Expos, not that hard, apparently, because it was the number one book in Canada, so I guess it did pretty well. I think it was one of those things where there was pent-up demand for this kind of subject where people missed the Expos. You know, the first book that I wrote, The Extra 2%, did much better here than in Canada. I think that there were honestly a lot of people back home in Montreal who just were not aware that I was writing for a living or anything, like I just didn't have a name or whatever. This was a totally different thing. I was more advanced in my career, number one. But number two, I was writing about a subject that was near and dear to everybody's heart. And I heard from people in Saskatchewan and British Columbia and Newfoundland or whatever, not just Montreal, saying how much they loved it and how if it wasn't them, then their dad grew up with the Expos. Because as we said, it was the only team in Canada for a long time. So people really reacted in a very visceral way. People are still tweeting me this day saying, I read page 273 and I was crying. You know, this is serious stuff. You don't get that if you write just a run-of-the-mill book. But this had emotion in it. I think that people responded to it in that way. Also, I think, quite frankly, it's a better book. I think that I just wrote this better and did a better job of it. And so the end result was that people just gravitated toward the thing. They really dug it. And it was a baseball story in some sense. But number one, baseball is absolutely viable in Canada, despite what happens if the Expos are a lot of baseball fans. And number two, I think that it's a fundamentally Canadian story, too. I mean, the book starts off by talking about Expo 67 and the rise of Montreal in the 60s and what the city was like. It's a history book, really. I mean, yeah, it's about Rusty Staub and Vladimir Guerrero, but it's also about kind of the rise and fall of the city, and politics are involved and business is involved, and it's pretty rich. So I think if you're into stuff like that, that's another way to approach the book, again, whether you're from Montreal or whether you're from, you know, Manitoba.
And the extra 2%, we should say, is a book about the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, as they were called in those days. And it's more of a business book. In fact, I think I found it in the business section of my local Barnes & Noble rather than the sports section.
Oh,
and it's also worth saying that whereas the Expos book is number one, extra 2% is number two on the best-selling baseball books in Amazon Canada.
Well, that's good, I guess.
So it seems you got an uptick on the extra 2% from the up, up, and away.
Yeah, I suppose so. So, yeah, no, I mean, one was obviously much better received. The up, up, and away was number one among all nonfiction books in Canada. That's a little different than the extra 2%. But, yeah, the extra 2% did get an uptick, and that was cool to see.
Where did the title come from?
Up, up, and away is a home run call of Dave Van Horn, who was the play-by-play guy for 32 years, I believe it is. Yeah, through 2000. And it comes from an old song from the 70s. What the heck is the name of the band? Fifth Dimension sang that song. Kind of a pop song, whatever. Not a particularly great song, but it was popular at the time. Van Horn didn't really have a home run call at first. I think he kind of instituted it right around when the song came out, which was like maybe 71, 72. And it stuck. It was just one of those things that he went with. And we were deciding on the title, and we had some ideas. We were playing, you know, thinking about wordplay with the word expo, obviously, or exposed or whatever. But Up, Up, and Away kind of resonated because it had that feel of, you know, they had a journey, and then ultimately they went away, so we thought about that. And I also just thought about how Van Horn was the voice of my childhood. If you root for a team, you gravitate toward the radio voice of that team. It tends to be how it goes, especially, you know, I'm turning 40 next month, so I think if you're of that age especially, or older, then that is very much how you would interact with a team, because they were just not on TV all the time back in the day. And it's not just, you know, thinking about them at home or on the East Coast or whatever. The most vivid memories I have were as a little kid, kind of sneaking a radio under the covers or whatever, which is the most traditional, stereotypical little boy kind of stuff, and listening to them playing the Dodgers, the Padres, or the Giants at 11:30 at night on the radio. And that was Van Horn. And so when we came up with this idea, we said maybe we should do this. My friend Adam Cortez, actually, who is a big Expo fan and grew up in Montreal, is the one who was first suggested the title, so credit to him. I went to Van Horn. I developed a relationship with him over the years, which was pretty cool. When one of your, you know, big childhood influences, you get to know the person. I just asked him flat out, "Do we have your permission?" He said, "I'm flattered. I'm honored. Please go ahead." And you know, one of the first people I gave the book to was Dave Van Horn, and he goes on Facebook and Instagram or whatever, and he says, "This is the book that we needed. This is the definitive Expos book. This is the one that needed to be told." And I was just like, "Man, I mean, you can't get higher praise than that." You know what I mean? It's like you're writing a history book and Doris Kearns Goodwin says, "Damn, you knocked that crap out of the park." You know, that's kind of how I felt about it. So very, very nice and very heartening to hear that from somebody like Van Horn.
Now, the photograph on the cover depicts Andre Dawson. Ball in the upper left corner, it looks like he's hit that home run. How much thought went into the cover of the book? I know authors don't always have a lot of say in it when it comes to that, but for picking Dawson as the emblem of the Expo, so to speak.
So my editor, Paul Thompson, who was an editor at Random House in New York, and then he moved to Canada because he wanted to move back to Canada, was with this book was published by Random House Canada. He and I are about the same age, with similar sensibilities, and it's a very casual relationship. We are friends, you know, and we happen to have this working relationship. So yes, you're right that authors often get shut out of this, of the decisions like that, but this was never going to be the case. It was always going to be a collaborative project. Editing, design, publicity, all of it has been great. It's really fun to work with those guys, all of Random House, really. And so when the cover design was being talked about, I think that part of it was based on the title. You know, Up, Up, and Away was the home run call, so we thought, well, let's try to get a home run hitter. Then we thought about the idea of, did we want a photo or did we want a depiction? We actually tossed around the idea of having, this is something that didn't happen, but it was going to be a baseball with an Expos, an old school Expos hat on it, the tricolor one that looks like a beanie, and it would have a propeller on the top of the beanie, and the ball would kind of be levitating off the page as if the sail's going up, up, and away, which is very cute, but also kind of young adulty, just, you know, a little bit on the childlike scale. So we scrapped that, and we wanted to, we just decided on a cool picture. So then we had to figure out who was going to be a home run hitter. Okay, so they have lots of home run hitters in franchise history, Gary Carter, Vladimir Guerrero. My favorite player of all time is Tim Raines. But not necessarily known as a home run guy, so that wasn't going to work. And finally, we decided that the old school uniforms, you know, the 80s uniforms, really typified the Expos. And then Andre Dawson was one of the greatest players in franchise history, and he had that classic kind of uppercut swing, and it just worked perfectly. And when we put it on the page, and Paul sent it to me, I said, oh, that looks amazing. Let's just do that. So that's how it came to be.
Did you consider other formats for the book? There are several sections in here where it takes the form of an oral history, where the players speak about various events. Did you ever consider making this simply an oral history book?
Yes, I absolutely did. It's a great question. In preparation for the book, I read a book called Bums, which you might know. Terrific book by... Gollenbach, that's right. And Gollenbach and I are even in touch, and he's a big Rays fan, actually, so we got to know each other a little bit with Extra 2%. And so I read that... great book, by the way. Great, great book. And I thought, well, this is cool. Also, The Glory of the Times is my favorite baseball or sports book of all, maybe my favorite book, period, of all time. Just brilliantly told, and is just straight oral history, basically. So I thought about it. I think what made me decide not to do it was because you couldn't properly spin the business and kind of cultural side of it that way. It wouldn't really work in exactly the same way. I had to bring that. What is it you call it as an author? I think it's called the voice of authority, where you have to be able to collate the facts and then present them and say, here is what happened. And that wasn't going to work quite as well if I was talking to some policy wonk or politician or whatever, and he was like, yes, here is how business was like in Montreal in 1973. It was going to be weird. For the baseball stuff, really good. And the only section that's really entirely oral history is the story of Blue Monday, which is a home run hit by a guy named Rick Monday in 1981, which led the Dodgers over the Expos and into the World Series. And it's not even about really the whole season or about the whole series, in essence. It's about almost entirely that one at bat. And it's everybody. I talked to Monday himself, who I wanted to hate, but he was a gentleman, so that was nice. And then I talked to Tim Raines and Andre Dawson and Juan Cromartie. And they were just giving their visceral reactions to something that had happened 30-odd years ago. But it was so crystal clear to all these guys, you know, on the Dodgers side, they were elated. I talked to Mike Socha as well. How much they were just fired up about it. And for the Expos, it was just like, we were the best team. We were supposed to win this. We didn't. We were pissed off about it, whatever. And I'm not going to ruin it. It's worth reading the book. But the kicker, the final quote from Warren Cromartie about Rick Monday's home run is probably my favorite part of the book. It's just, it's so raw, it's so visceral, and it just perfectly tells the story of what happened. And I thought that in that case, because you had those sentiments on the page as opposed to talking about politics or business, that could just be told to the players now. That if I tried to be a conduit, I would be getting in the way.
If readers want to find out more about your work, this book in particular, is there a website they can go to?
JonahKerry.com, JonahKerry.com. I have to say, I do not update it frequently, but it is a kind of a headquarters for, you know, just looking for book links and things like that. But, you know, Amazon, local indie bookstores are great. So if you're ordering online, Powell's.com will ship anywhere, or if you live in whatever city, support your local indie. That's absolutely a good move. The book is coming out in French. Alors, si vous parlez français, so you can get that very soon. That'll be a lot of fun. And there will be a paperback coming out in 2015 with a new epilogue, because there's been some fun stuff that's happened since this book came out. We had two exhibition games at Olympic Stadium. 96,000 people showed up at the stadium, which was pretty amazing.
Wow.
So we're going to talk about that. Yeah, amazing. And we're going to talk about that and the rise in enthusiasm that's happened even in just the last, few months or a year here for the possibility, however remote, of baseball maybe coming back to Montreal.
Did you actually write the French version?
No, just a translation deal. I still speak French reasonably well, and I used to write in French, but I think getting the real nuances of it down, and moreover, just having to write 416 pages in another language is just, you know, it wasn't going to make sense for my time. It wasn't going to be financially feasible or whatever. This is just basically a straight translation from a company that knows what it's doing and has experience with sports books and is good. So I expect that they'll do it pretty well.
And we have been talking with Jonah Carey, author of the new Expos history, Up, Up, and Away, The Kid, The Hawk, Rock, Vladdy, Pedro, La Grande Orange, Yuppie, The Crazy Business of Baseball, and the ill-fated but unforgettable Montreal Expos. And that has to be some sort of record for the longest baseball title.
Well, you know what? The previous book was pretty long, too, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First. The extra 2% is very short, but the subhead is very long. Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's SEO, Ron. I mean, you know that stuff. You want to search for a book, you search for, I don't know, Vladdy, and suddenly it comes up. You go, whoa, what's this? You know, so we did it that way. But, I mean, from a non-cynical point of view, aside from SEO, there were a lot of people that needed to be honored. I mean, you just want to say the Expos, they were a cool team, but that's insufficient. You need to say more than that. And I think evoking the name, talking about Le Grand Orange is something that really, if you were an Expos fan, that resonates. That makes you say, oh man, that takes me back. I got to pick this thing up. So we really tried to do service to those people, to Tim Raines and Rusty Staub and Pedro Martinez and Bobby Dawson, Gary Carter, and so on.
Well, that's what did it for me, is I had to pick up this book, and the fact that it was by you just made it all the more fun. So, Jonah Carey, merci bien.
Thank you, Ron.
And that was our bookshelf conversation with Jonah Carey, author of Up, Up, and Away. That wraps up this podcast edition, a little longer than usual, but very enjoyable. I think you'll agree. Come back again next time when our guest will be Josh Ostergaard, author of The Devil's Snake Curve, A Fan's Notes from Left Field. Remember to visit Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf regularly for the latest baseball news. And don't forget to enter our giveaway contest. Leave a comment. Maybe you'll win a book. So take care, everybody. Thanks again. Bird says goodbye. That's bird talk for goodbye. And you got to feed me now. And talk to you again next time. Have a good holiday. Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.